Party people, and welcome to Icy Strait Point, Alaska. Although, of course, as I say those words out loud, it is clearly not icy here right now. It is the beginning of August. I try to take an Alaskan cruise like once a year to go off and do planning things for the company and for my personal life as well. I can't recommend enough yearcompass.com. Yearcompass.com is this totally free planning document that helps you review how your last year has been and what you expect to do for the next year. It's really, I find it very fulfilling. There's a bunch of other documents I use for my little planning retreats as well. And I personally find Alaska cruises a great way to do it, just solo, going by myself. It's very contemplative. It's timeless. It's beautiful out here. And on a lot of these cruises, like, I don't even get off the boat anymore because I've been to so many Alaska cruises now. I think I've probably been up here a dozen times. And it's just jaw-dropping every time. Same kinds of things that I love about Iceland. I think Iceland has much more to see. Alaska cruises are just a great way to disconnect and be at peace for a while. I don't even get off the boat half the time. Like Icy Strait Point, it's basically a cruise ship excursion island built to cater to cruise ship passengers. There's a gondola, a tram, a zip line. You can go salmon fishing, eagle watching, but it's not really authentic local stuff. It's really kind of built for the tourists. And it's glorious weather. Oh my gosh, it's like it's 64 right now, 64 degrees Fahrenheit. This is about perfect. I will say you'll see me wearing kind of bulky pants. The one of the best pieces of advice I can give you for Alaska or Iceland is waterproof pants and shoes. As long as you can be comfortable when it rains, because it does rain a lot in Alaska, despite what you see out here with this glorious sunny day. Get waterproof pants and boots, very important. So let's go through your top voted questions from PollGab. Username I cannot comprehend, I adjusted my chest today, asks, on a new SQL Server 2022 instance, do you default to varchar or nvarchar when you're designing new strings? I simply ask, do we need to store Unicode in here? And Japanese kanji characters, you know, strange kinds of strings, or is this simply an American database designed for Americans that holds American type stuff in it? Because I work primarily with United States companies, I have a few Canadian and European clients, but it's a much smaller number. If I had to guess, I'd say I'm 90%, maybe 95% American companies. Then the vast majority of databases that I work with, they're just supporting American names and part numbers and strings and whatnot. If you look, even when you're doing things like email addresses or websites, if you go check to see what the standards support, odds are you're still going to be just stuck with varchar type things. Now, having said that, you asked when I design stuff, what do? I start by asking that. But what I see most often out in the field is nvarchar is used much more often because Entity Framework's code first stuff tends to create nvarchar without asking. Next up, Index et al. Says, hi Brent, I work in a small organization. My first 2 to 3 years were hell as I was the first database administrator. I can identify with that, I've been there too. Says, things are really slow now. I'm going through most of the courses that you have. My manager wants me to brag about my job. What will you advise for me to focus on for relevance? If your manager wants you to show your successes, and this really happens with all kinds of jobs, not just database administrators, your managers will ask you how to prove that you're being successful. SP Blitz is actually one of my favorite ways to do as a database administrator. Log the contents of SP Blitz to a table and then say, at the beginning of this year, I had this many servers and this many urgent warnings in SP Blitz. Now, through the course of the year, as I've worked through things, I have more servers because our company has grown, and I have less warnings because I've been able to fix all these urgent things. I say that first because it's a really easy piece of data to gather. It doesn't take you a lot of work to gather that data. And it also reminds you that you should be focusing on things like not having backups, not having corruption checking. The next thing, if you could go a little bit deeper, I'd look at the number of tickets that you've resolved, like assuming that you use GitHub issues, Jira issues, whatever it is. How many issues were you involved in that you marked as resolved? And that'll help show progress on the work that you've been tasked to do. A lot of the time as database administrators, our work is a combination of reactive and proactive. We have to fix complaints that get thrown at us, and then we also have to reach out and start proactively moving to new versions, for example, getting on supported operating systems. And so you don't always get tickets for the proactive stuff, and that's where it starts to become a lot harder to track your successes. Ooh, next up, SQL Saturday Junkie says, what location has been your favorite SQL or Data Saturday event to speak at worldwide and in the US? And then they have another part to the question. But I'm gonna answer that in a couple of different ways because it's kind of fun and interesting. Right about now, the local organizers, every SQL Saturday and Data Saturday is organized by local volunteers. Every one of them is leaning forward to hear, not every one of them, but the ones who are watching this recording are leaning forward to hear what my answer is because they take great pride in organizing their events. I can't tell you the last time that I was at a badly organized SQL Saturday or Data Saturday. By now, there are run books as to how you run a good event. So everybody who I've come to your events, believe me, I haven't given you any negative feedback because I haven't had any negative feedback. So for me, the events that tend to be the most fun or the ones that I get the most excited about are in the locations that I'm the most excited to go to. So it really doesn't have anything to do with the fault or blame of the organizers. It's just that places that I really want to go to. So worldwide, I think my favorite was Israel because it was one of those locations that I would never normally be able to justify going to. It's expensive as an American to get to Israel. It involves long flights. I don't have any Israeli clients, and I'm sure I never will because there are great consulting firms in Israel who have a very deep hold on the local markets, and everybody knows them very well, so they wouldn't have any reason to call a foreigner like me. So it was amazing to be able to go to SQL Saturday Iceland or SQL Saturday Israel. And I loved it. So, and it's not on a Saturday. It's one of the few that isn't on a Saturday. Austria was another one. So that was a big favorite for me. And the event was extremely well run and was a ton of fun. And I really had a great time and enjoyed myself. Ended up going back. I think I've been there 3 times. So that was a favorite of mine. There have been so many amazing locations around the world. Iceland, throughout Scandinavia. I can't remember if I did one in Puerto Rico or not. I know I was there for a client, but I don't think we were able to get to the SQL Saturday down there. In the United States, the best organized ones tend to be in the Southeast, like Florida and Atlanta, and then also in the LA area. Those parts of the country are very disciplined about how those work. In terms of my favorite to go to, though, probably, it'd probably be Boston, just because I have a lot of friends in the Boston and Salem, Massachusetts area. And I always look forward to going there again next month, actually. So I'll see you over at SQL Saturday Boston. Super excited about that. Oh, also excited about Houston. I'm going to Houston. I think I've spoken at SQL Saturday Houston once before, maybe twice, but I'm going again this coming November. And I'm excited about that just because I adore Houston. I love Houston. I lived there twice in my life for several years. The restaurant scene is great. I mean, it's got a whole lot of really, not like necessarily the world's best fine dining, like Michelin star type stuff, but just good food, great Cajun food, great Tex-Mex food, great barbecue, and easy to get in and out. Giant city, very affordable. Really love it a lot. Second part of the Sequel Saturday Junkie's question was, how much work is it to plan for a full day pre-con? So there are two parts of that. One is planning and selling the course, like getting people to actually attend. The other is building the material. Generally speaking, for every hour's worth of material, you should expect to spend somewhere between 1 day and 1 week to build that material. The more demos there are, the more technically accurate it has to be, the more research that you have to put in, the more you should expect to be that number to be closer to a week. I've had some hours of my session materials take months over the period of time to build. How to Think Like the Engine is a great example of that. So building the training material is certainly the most challenging part, the most time-consuming part. But actually marketing your session is so important because so many people think that just build it and they will come, and that is not how it works. I've been through one conference after another where my sessions are absolutely packed and someone else who has great technical material only has 10 people in their session. And that presenter will ask me, Brent, how is it that your sessions are so packed? And I'm like, it all just comes down to marketing. Just all comes down to building an email list, talking to those people, emailing them on a regular basis, sending them valuable information for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then when you're ready to actually be in their area, that they'll be ready to pull the trigger and buy because you've been giving them so much free, valuable stuff over time. Marketing is incredibly important there. All right, let's see here. Next up, that one took so long that I know my cell phone would have lost connection to PolGab, so I got to go pull PolGab back up here. Next up, Mike asks, where do you think is a better place to post technical articles? MS SQL Tip, SQL Server Central, Redgate, LinkedIn, or something else? Please take into account whether it's peer-reviewed, how quickly it's posted, the number of views or popularity of the website. Okay, so I got some tough news for you here. I don't think that the best place to post your stuff is someone else's site. Because over time, those sites can and do go away. They invest different amounts of money. For example, right now, their investments are dropping dramatically because of AI. Their hits are just plummeting. Their hits are going down so quickly because people who are asking questions and trying to find results in text-based web searches simply aren't going to those sites anymore. They're posting their question in Google. Google's AI-based summaries are giving people their answer without having to go to the website. So those sites which make money on advertising are no longer making that money on advertising, so they can't afford to do as much peer review, and they're just pushing text out the door for as cheaply as they possibly can. I don't say that to slander those sites. I love those sites. I hope all of them continue forever. I wish that we weren't having this problem, but simple economics dictates that we are having this problem, that cow has left the barn. So what I would recommend if you want to write something is ask yourself, why am I writing this? If you're writing this to help your career, post it on your own site. Post it on your website that you control so that you can control the editorial nature of it, that you don't have to worry about ads appearing alongside of it, that the site exists to promote you, that you can link to it confidently on your resume, and people will be impressed that you have that site. No one is going to get famous, quote unquote, from writing for any of those sites anymore. Those days are over. A long time ago, there was something called Sequel Magazine that would actually exist in larger bookstores. You could go and buy a copy of it off the shelf, or you could subscribe to it. And people like Itzhak Ben-Gon and Kimberly Tripp and Paul Randall got famous by having columns in those magazines. Those days are gone. The whole conventional media is just gone, and that'll never recover. So write what you want. Get your peers to review it, send them drafts out, and then you can publish it as quickly as you want. Now, is it going to have a million people reading it? No, but frankly, neither are the big sites anymore. So that's what makes it kind of interesting. Apocalyptic is another way of saying that. I mean, things are pretty terrible right now for conventional media. It's kind of sad. All right, let's see here. Next up, next up we have Hanny, who says, "Hi Brent, in the year 2025, when SQL Server 2025 should be released anytime soon, and I have no particular problem I'm trying to solve, just migrating from one cloud vendor to another, should I stay on SQL Server 2019, or should we upgrade to SQL Server 2022 at the same time?" Change equals risk. Change equals risk. I drive this home to clients all the time. That was a ship's horn over there. I think the Norwegian Bliss is pulling out, so we may be able to see it here, depending on what path they take out. Change equals risk. So don't change things if you don't have to change them. Your peers, your internal customers are already going to be upset during the migration. They're going to blame you for things that aren't a problem. This query used to be fast, but now it's slow. I think it's your fault. And we all know that it wasn't really fast before. It was always slow. They're just using this as an excuse to get you to do some work for them. So don't change things just because you want to. Plan a separate timeline for that. Do that when you need to do that. Next up, Chris asks, "How can one benchmark disk performance on a SQL Server platform as a service, so like Azure SQL DB or Amazon RDS? I'd like to ensure that we're getting the disk performance that we're paying for. However, I understand Crystal Disk Mark is meant to run locally from an operating system." So you can't directly performance test disk. You can indirectly do it by doing things like write tests, by writing synthetic load tests to insert data into a table and see how much you can insert. To do this, let's talk a little bit more deeply about how this works, because this is kind of fun and I love doing stuff like this. Do I have any clients who ever pay me for this? No, this is just something that I love doing whenever Microsoft or Amazon tells me that they've solved a disk bottleneck issue. I'm like, really? Watch this. And then let's go run a load test together and see how it works. So in order to understand it, what you want to do is you want to have a table where every row is one 8K page. You're going to define the data types on that table so that one row takes up exactly one 8K page. And then you're going to see how many rows per second that you can load. You're going to do it over an extended period of time, say like 5, 10, 15 minutes, so that you can know you're saturating past any easy caching mechanisms. And you're going to see, take the number of pages, number of rows, same thing, the number of rows that you were able to write during that time, take that's 8 kilobytes, convert it into gigabytes or megabytes, whichever unit of measure you like better, and that'll tell you how many megabytes or gigabytes per second or per minute that you were able to load through their disk subsystems. Now, is that exactly accurate? No, because of course with B-trees, there are supporting mechanisms where you're going to be writing additional 8K pages, but it'll at least get you a rough starting point of whether or not it's even close. Also, make sure to read the documentation. That sounds kind of obvious and self-serving, but read the documentation, because the vendors will usually flat out tell you, here are the bottlenecks on how much you're allowed to write in megabytes per second to the transaction log. Let's see here. How long we've been going? Oh, goodness, we've been going quite a while. All right, we'll do one more. Oh, this is a good one. I got to load up PolGab again here to make sure I can record this. Do, 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 do. So this one's interesting. So this is from I Use Uppercase for Select, who says, what's a common problem you see that even though you see it a lot, it's hard to find the root cause? Okay, so first off, if it's something that I see a lot, I just write utilities so that I can see it more quickly. And they're not hidden secret utilities. Every troubleshooting script and utility that I write, I make part of the first responder kit. So it's open source so that everybody can go track these problems down quicker. I'm not really interested in job security. There's more than enough work for me to handle going forward. So the stuff that I see a lot, if I see a problem two or three times, I just write it into the first responder kit. Sometimes, even if I only see it once, if it's something that I'll give you a classic example. I have a client that brings me on site every year during their peak loads. And while that happens, I see a lot of cool things in SQL Server that I would never normally get the chance to see. So because of that, and I can reproduce it right then and there under a load. So because of that, I'll usually just add a bunch of things to the first responder kit that I see live on their servers, even though I may never see it again. I think it's just cool, and I think that somebody else will probably see it. So the answer that you're looking for, though, is stuff that's hard to find the root cause of. I'll tell you what it would be for me is availability group failovers. Now, I don't do availability group work. I haven't done availability group work in like 10 years because it's a giant pain in the butt. Microsoft isn't building easier troubleshooting materials for availability groups. In fact, AGs have only gotten more complex with the advent of AGs on Linux, clusterless AGs, distributed AGs, contained availability groups. Microsoft keeps stacking on features, but they don't make troubleshooting any easier. So after an unexpected failover happens, answering the question of why did it happen sucks. Often it's things like, well, you had an AG a lease timeout. And somebody says, why did we have a lease timeout? I can't tell you. I can't tell you if a network was congested at a particular point in time, if one of the SQL servers happened to drop offline in terms of a network issue, if there was a cloud network failure, if there was a temporary failure to see the quorum disk, if the quorum disk actually went offline as opposed to us being unable to see it. Doing that kind of root cause troubleshooting is a giant pain in the rear. But then again, that's also why I got out of the availability group business. I don't see that getting any easier to solve. If somebody wanted to build a tool to make that easier, I would highly recommend doing it as open source, not because I want to use it. I don't really care about that. Like I said, I don't do AG troubleshooting work anymore. I get clients who want me to do it, and I'm like, no, sorry, I'm just not interested. But the reason that I would advise you to make it open source, as opposed to trying to profit off of it, is that people aren't going to pay for it. What happens is the AG failed over on Tuesday. They're now Googling around trying to find out how to, you know, what the root cause was or how to prevent it. But if you even showed them a product that would do it for $100, they're like, eh, we're going to keep digging. Because once the cluster's already failed over, they're not really that urgent in order to get the root cause answer. They just think they want to find a set of tools to make it easier to find out. When it happens repeatedly, when it happens a lot, that the cluster keeps failing over, or the AG keeps failing over, they're still not going to buy it. They're going to go hire someone who knows how to troubleshoot it. They're going to go either call Microsoft support and open a case, or they're going to go to a consultant that they found somewhere in order to troubleshoot it. they're not going to believe that a tool would make it easy, because the tool won't make it easy. The tool's only going to make it easy for a human being to analyze those logs to understand what the root cause was. You have to gather logs from so many different sources, not only from SQL Server, but also from Windows, across several boxes that might be in different Windows domains. It's not like you're going to automate the data collection of that across multiple domains to actually make that easy enough, and let alone that you're going to do that for $100 or $500. And the higher that the price tag goes, the less likely it is someone's willing to actually spend the money to make that happen. I'm always kind of chuckle at the prices of tooling where people won't pay. You know, it's, people really expect a lot of tooling to be free or open source these days. All right, well, there we go. There's a bunch of your questions. It is now 3:00. We didn't see the ship come by through here. I don't think that ship's actually left. The Norwegian Bliss is still over there. I don't see any other cruise ships. I mean, there's another small cruise ship over there somewhere. Hopefully y'all had fun. I've repeatedly tried. I have a little Insta 360 camera that I'm filming this on. I have repeatedly tried to get this thing so that it does 360 video and you can click around. I've also announced a couple of times that, hey, if you're watching this through YouTube, you can drag and click the video around and see different angles. I think maybe this might be the first one where you might be able to do it. We'll see what happens after it goes live. Fingers crossed, I sure hope so. Because I go to so many cool visual places that I would love for you to just be able to look around and see what's going on out here. And I have more trips traveled, more travel planned in the future too as well. After this cruise, and I may do another office hours out in Ketchikan or Skagway, depending on how many questions pile up. In the next couple few days while I'm out on the cruise. I go home, and then September, I think, is my next one, going out to SQL Saturday Boston. And I've done office hours in Salem, Massachusetts a couple of times out in the witch graveyards. That would be kind of fun for you to see around as well. So thanks for hanging out with me. Hope y'all had fun and learned something. Adios. I think I can click this button and it'll stop recording too.